Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my special guest is Daniel Matalon. Daniel's the founder of Is There Enough? A provocative new conversation about the intersection of survival, economics, and social justice. Dan, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. Thank you for coming on the show. How are you?
I'm really well. I'm really glad to be here talking about an edgy idea simply because it's so simple.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I don't know so much about what you're doing, but let's begin with the beginning. So what does Is There Enough mean? What are you about?
So that is an accidental question I stumbled onto, to be very frank and transparent about how this came about. But it starts a conversation in which people tend to find agreement rather than conflict. And in fact, we think that, as I'm writing in a forthcoming book coming out in 2023, that humanity is not as threatened by climate change and tribalism and inequality and whatever other social ill we're concerned about as by our lack of ability to collaborate sufficiently to meet those challenges. You and I are probably not very warlike, but we come from 70,000 years of war, and those tendencies exist in our culture, not just in the sense of war of picking up a gun and shooting somebody, but in all the other aspects of war that we promulgate almost automatically. And so our conversation of is there enough seems to be a splash in the water that gets people to recognize that there really is a way in which people can ask, what can we do about it? Whatever that social ill is, right?
Yeah.
And once we're on that place of we and what we can do about it, we're really faced with either conflict or agreement. And the thing about conflict and war is at the end of it, there's always a treaty. And we waste a lot of blood, treasure, and time getting there. And humanity doesn't have a lot of time, you know, if you believe that we're living in existential threats, which I certainly do.
That's interesting. So you're basically saying the fundamental challenge human beings facing is actually working together collaboratively. And if we can do that, then the rest kind of fits together. We can address climate change, we can address wars, we can address social injustice, etc. Have I got that right?
You do. And as you would expect from somebody promoting the idea of agreement as something of a superpower we're not really using, we in no way think that our conversation is the way or the only way or some best way or something like that. We think we need 1,000 flowers blooming on this topic. Our approach is a very simplistic one, something that even a 5-year-old can understand. And I was actually once challenged to make that case by going to a kindergarten and talking to kindergarten kids about this in an age-appropriate way. And 3 months later, they were asking me to come back. And all I did was have a conversation with them about how they got their breakfast that morning, which involved collaboration of some sort, right? And they were able to extrapolate that and put it into use. This really gave me a lot of comfort that, you know, the future generations have an aptitude for this. If we can start to recognize with clarity that a lot of our social ills come about by, and tribalism is, you know, so well expressed as a version of this, but there are other aspects of it as well. Even in the climate debate, there is unnecessary warring and conflict, then would help us to actually address climate change, for example. And I'm one of Al Gore's 30 or 40,000 now climate train reality activists, and I have this conversation with my fellow climate activists all the time, that we need to be really looking at how to bridge our divides, not ostracizing people who don't think the way that we do.
Yeah, so, I mean, hard to disagree with it, Dan, hard to disagree. I mean, I'm a Quaker. I've studied Buddhism. I've studied psychoanalysis. And they've been preaching collaboration and pacifism and did this kind of thing for many, many years. So what do you think you're bringing? What edge are you bringing to this? What difference are you bringing to this?
The answer to that question is as simple as it may sound here, and people can experience this for themselves in a self-paced format that we've put together on our website, istherenough.org. But the answer to your question, I believe, is that the asking of the question of enough transcends the argument over scarcity and abundance. Because enough is not abundance and enough is not scarcity. It's something else. And ironically, when people debate, and we've conducted thousands of hours of social research on this in 22 countries, what we found is that when people are asking each other their own definitions of enough, no two people have the same answer. Mm-hmm. In fact, the answer to is there enough is, as the conversation goes, which is there's enough of this and there's not enough of that. Right? It's not really yes or no when you ask the question, is there enough? And the qualification of what you think there's enough of and what I think there's enough of is as unique as a fingerprint. And through that conversation, people are having, I wouldn't call it empathy in the sense of compassion emotionally, but they're at least building some cognitive empathy of each other, understanding the perspective of another individual in a way that they would not normally have done without that conversation being in place. And it allows us to put the responsibility to the question of is there enough in the hands of the person who is answering it. Because what you will discover in our research and work and background is we are derivative of Buckminster Fuller and his concept of the world game, not a war game, but a world game. And his world game was about how to make the world work for 100% of humanity. And he had some qualifications in there through spontaneous collaboration, the shortest time possible without ecological offense or disadvantage to anyone. We just boiled that down quite accidentally, I should tell you, to the question of, is there enough? And it's a question. It's not an assertion. We're not telling people that there's enough. We're just simply dropping a stone in the water and asking. And it isn't always the three words, is there enough? If you're dealing with a more particular topic, there's quite a different way of framing it. The is there enough question between me and my significant other in my relationship is quite different in wording, but it has the same sense of how do we emerge out of this rather than me or you winning and losing? How can we all win together? So it's a pop conversation, I would say, of all that Quaker Buddhist philosophy you just referred to in a way, as Einstein said, I think, it's been attributed to him that if you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you probably don't really have it, loosely translated. And that's basically what we are, is the pop kids version of understanding the personal value, not just only the social value of agreement.
And do you work in, have you tried this out in sort of a conflict resolution situations? So like in America, you've got huge culture wars at the moment, you know, you've got kind of Trump, you've got kind of the liberal, you've got the liberal progressive kind of ideas, you've got these culture wars. Have you kind of put people in a room together and worked with this?
Yes, I didn't really know I was doing social research at the time, a few years back when I had sort of some epiphanies of the value of agreement towards the world game concept, which I've been interested in for 30 years, or even asking a question rather than asserting and telling people that there's abundance, which I also failed at doing for 30 years. And some of my initial social research was with Trump supporters who, for me and my politics, were very opposite from me. And I also met Mr. Trump in a media situation where I got to see him backstage. So I had a real anathema to Mr. Trump as a personality, never mind his positions. And I was just horrified. But once I had this discovery about what could be accomplished with agreement in a new way, I said, well, if I'm going to get really good agreement, I better find agreement with people I don't agree with.
Yeah.
So I found about 30 or so individuals in that. So the DNA roots of that conversation have continued to this day, where I'm on Clubhouse having conversations. We're doing some really interesting things on Clubhouse that have not been done before. For your audience to know and follow up. But when I was in Clubhouse, I would often find myself in conversations with liberals and conservatives in multiple countries arguing over their basic set of truths. And one of the things that came out of all of that conversation is there's a distinction between agreements of value and agreements of position. Mm-hmm. a conservative and a liberal agree on the value of fairness. What they mean by fairness is very different. Yeah. And it's really critically important that if you have the intention of making the world work, that is, and not burning it down, and there's plenty of those who want to burn everything down to start again and whatnot. But if you really want to make the world work, starting with a common value and expressing it overtly, we've tested this, and then having the arguments about the positions has a very different outcome. For example, a Trump supporter and a non-Trump supporter, if they had a conversation, I don't know, ritually or by some incentive, like the way they sing the national anthem, could just go, let's agree we're both Americans. I'm Canadian, by the way, but just in that example, let's agree we're both Americans. Now let's argue about everything else. We've tested that. And it has a different outcome of respect for each other at the end of the day, even if it didn't change any positions. And that's vital to the survival of the human race, in my opinion.
So tell me, Dan, what's your personal skin in the game here? Why are you kind of so attached to this and engaged in it? What's driving you on this mission?
Is there enough as an accidental conversation that's, you know, become supported, engaged by people as, guess, something of a quasi movement around the world? And I'm very proud of that work, but I look at it somewhat with minor amount of objectivity, because it sort of came as a surprise to me, because I uttered the question, is there enough, almost in some exasperation, isn't there enough to an audience of people? And there was sort of a ripple effect of that. But the primary work, the agenda, the skin in the game, as you put it, preceded Is There Enough, which is a concept of how to make social impact investing, social impact finance, for-profit social impact finance, far more capitalized than it is. And we think that there's some unnecessary. Yep.
Did you want to say? What I'm asking you is like your own something personal, kind of. What is it that drives you, rather than kind of the objectives? What is it that kind of is there in your personal history within you, which has kind of put you on this mission?
Yeah, if you ask me personally, I lost everything I had financially, friends, relationships. Basically, felt like my life was over in my mid 50s. I was sleeping on a couch. I had one client at the time, and the compensation for my work was the couch that I was living on. And I don't know how it clued into me in that depression that I was in at the time, but somebody was knocking on my door really wanting me to work with them. And I kept pushing them away because I sort of felt I was, you know, worthless and so on. And they just kept sort of pulling me off the proverbial couch. Ended up, you know, working with that company and another as well. But somehow I put together the idea that I could keep on moving and keep on living as long as I focused on everybody else's needs and not mine. And once I started to have a little financial success doing exactly that, I went, how could I make it bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger? And I came back to the original inspiration I had around Buckminster Fuller and the World Game about how to make the world work for 100% of humanity. So I took my emptiness, filled it with something else that I could live by, and then it became a passion.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. That's a powerful story. I mean, for me, I'm psychoanalytically trained. I'm a psychotherapist, so I these stories kind of making link to the personal, to the kind of macro, to the big picture. I think it's very helpful because it helps us make sense of the world around us. You mentioned that you were on a couch with nothing, and your big question is there enough?
Well, I wasn't even thinking the question. I've never made that connection before. You just made it for me. As I said to you, the question, is there enough, was uttered a few years after that. Mm. But I will tell you the ripple effect that took place from the utterance of this question. It was just like striking gold in the sand. 2 weeks after I uttered that question for the first time, my audience changed from my prospective investors I was aligning to my social impact finance goals. And the audience changed to journalists and educators and policymakers and an economist in Latin America who angrily told me that I was rewriting economic theory. Mm-hmm. Because our economic theory is basically that wealth, not money, but wealth itself is actually built by agreement, not by resources. Yeah, it's not just agreement that can save humanity. I mean, if you really look at how to increase your own personal fortunes, your family fortunes, your tribe and nations, it's all going to be about agreement. We human beings only get to agreement after we're exhausted in war. It's like, what did Churchill say about America? Is that Americans will do the right thing after they've exhausted everything else. I think that's a statement about humanity, not just about Americans. And I think that's true of us.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you also say that you it was just you and the couch. And of course, the couch in psychoanalysis has a specific meaning. It's where you do your inner work, your deep inner work. You lie on the couch and you go to unconscious places. I'm very interested in these links you're making. Do you have when you had nothing, you had no friends, you kind of lost all your finances, you lost your, you were depressed. Now you're on a mission. Do you have friends?
I do. I will tell you that I had a reason to say this the other day, but there are more human beings that I can look at the camera or be on the phone and say, I love you, than at any time in my history to this point, and genuinely feel that.
So this sense of purpose is changed your own life, and it's and you're trying to make a change in the world. Yeah.
Without a doubt. I will report to you that the conversation of Is There Enough, which was intended to give people a perspective on 100% of humanity and think about the world game and take responsibility for that, surprised me by people coming at it in a very personal way.
Yeah.
One of the most often quoted responses to the conversation of Is There Enough is, am I enough? Mm-hmm. Followed very closely by, are we enough?
Yeah.
And what I've just been amazed to discover is that people don't just look at how to make the world work for 100% of humanity, but how to make the world work for 100% of themselves or 100% of their world, however they define it. And so that's been a key, I think, to the engagement that our conversation has had and why it appeals to what we think of in society as the rugged individualist, which some people feel is a person who's selfish and doesn't care about society, but is a very important part of our society. We've clearly evolved those kind of brains for a reason. And yet it also appeals to the socially conscious, so to speak. And we think if you're going to make the world work for 100% of humanity, you're going to need to bring all those minds together in a common conversation.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like in psychoanalytic theory, we talk about splitting. So the idea of kind of either a scarcity or there's abundance, that's a classic splitting. And you see that you go down to California and everyone's talking about kind of a generative and abundance and stuff, you know, and there's kind of that narrative. You talk to environmentalists and people and they're always talking about scarcity and we're running out. So you get these juxtapositions, and this question, is there enough, is interesting. I studied a lot around the Northern Ireland peace process. I observed it as it was happening, and it was recently David Trimble, one of the political figures there, died. And it's interesting if you look at that process, because there are so many very difficult characters, like really difficult, very stuck in their positions. You know, there was a war going on, like people were getting killed and maimed. And these difficult characters somehow found enough agreement.
Exactly.
It's really quite interesting. Like, you know, I mean, I saw people come from positions I thought they would never, ever change. And they did. I think it's a classic study to make, to try and understand this. I think it'd be interesting to for you to look at it through that question, you know, how they came to kind of, is there enough? And the enough was an agreement which they could all live with, you know, and it stopped the war. And it was, but it's very, very kind of polarized, very strong characters, very kind of obstinate characters. Many you didn't like, you know, many disagreeable people, you know, you didn't kind of like, and actually ending up very admiring them because they actually really shifted their positions and they collaborated and they came together.
You know, I have some interesting things to validate what you're talking about. I've mentioned we're doing some interesting things on Clubhouse, and I had an opportunity to make some connection with one of the founders of Stop the Steal in the United States. And we were able to develop some comment, and I find his positions abhorrent. Mm-hmm. They're very anti-democracy, but through conversation, I was able to develop some respect for the fact that he has an actual philosophy, and one or two of those places have something to do with the value of human beings. Mm-hmm. And I will say that Adam Smith and Karl Marx actually agreed on that, right? The value of human capital. Yeah. Far more than what we call resources. There are inadvertent wars that go on between us, even who preach abundance. I have seen conflict amongst people who totally believe in abundance, and they're waiting for the rest of the world to wake up. And if they don't agree with them, they're just not as conscious as they are. And so we have a war between the conscious and the unconscious.
Yes.
It's just another version of good and bad. We have the same thing going on in the environmental movement, where we've created an inadvertent war between the people who defend the planet mm-hmm. against people who are attacking the planet. Yeah. And there's no sort of in between of those. I'm interested in we have sub conversations of, is there enough, that you can discover on our website under the Academy section. We think we're kind of an agreement academy for the world. And we have various experiences like that. And one of the sub conversations is about the word sustainability, which 99 times of 100, you hear that word and we're talking about environmental protection. We're not necessarily talking about the sustainability of the human race. Mm-hmm. Which is what our conversation of sustainability is. We believe that, excuse me, sorry, I'll have to remove that. We believe the conversation of sustainability, staying on that the earth versus humanity, is a path to destruction. We think that if you talk about the sustainability of the human race, you have to take care of the planet, because you cannot sustain the human race unless you do that. And when my friends at Group Partners in the UK, some really respected global change agents, they say, if you address the wrong question, you solve the wrong problem.
Yeah.
If your thing is to, as George Carlin said, the planet will be fine. It's humanity that needs saving.
Yeah. Do you do any psychological thinking in this? I mean, I studied populism. I studied polarized tribal behaviors. I kind of write about this stuff, and it's one thing people get a lot, that they get quite a lot of pleasure from their positions. So they get a lot of pleasure of being tribal, of joining together, of being anti something. You know, it brings you together. You can hate the other and the bad other. You can, you know, blame whether it's a liberal or whether it's a conservative. You can kind of you get quite a lot of pleasure from sort of creating a sort of gang mentality and blaming them. How do you address questions like that? I mean, if you one question I have is to get people to shift their positions, you have to kind of change the way they enjoy things, the way they gain pleasure. Do you ever think about that in your work, or come across any examples of how you shift kind of how people, yeah, actually enjoy themselves? Because Trump rallies are quite pleasurable for those who take part in them. You know, I mean. The ideas I find abhorrent. Actually, watch people, and they're people are getting a big kick out of going.
Yeah. So your question brings up something so fascinating in my writing of the book, The First Agreement, and I had this orphan chapter, mm-hmm. and I didn't know where it belonged, and I also was having trouble with kicking off the introduction and how the book was going to kick off, and of course. It dawned on me that my orphan chapter was my introduction. And what that introduction is about is identity. And what I say in that chapter is, I'm about to show you how to unlock a secret superpower called agreement on a humanity level, but you could use it in a personal development level if you wish. But you'll understand it cognitively and not be able to apply it unless you understand this chapter on identity. Because I don't think people will ever do anything that's inconsistent with their identity. The question is what is identity? And I'm a very simplistic guy. I'm not scholarly or studied or schooled or whatever. I'm an amateur at everything. But my amateur look at psychology boils down identity to history and choices. We are our history and we are our choices. Joe Dispenza says we're our choices only. I think we have to embrace our history as we project our choices too. And so in that light, right, am I having to be a MAGA supporter just because it's given me pleasure all this time, or do I have the potential of creating new pleasures? Mm-hmm. Is basically what I would answer to your question. We are our choices. I don't have to do everything I enjoyed doing just because I used to enjoy it. I used to do lots of things in my youth I don't do anymore. And some I've continued to do. So does that answer your question?
I mean, I don't think I answer. I think I don't think there is an answer. I think it's a process. And I think the question's important to ask at each stage of this, because people often think about people's defenses and how they defend their identities against the other. But I think it's very interesting to look about how people can very attached to ways of being, to ways of enjoying, and that can be very kind of polarizing. And you're right to say that we have to find new ways for people to enjoy and people to find pleasure. Otherwise, they just stick with the same old way. So unless you find new ways for them to enjoy, then people will continue on the same place. So, like, you know, the people in Northern Ireland, they made some huge moves, but there was a pleasure and satisfaction in getting world recognition for what they were doing, for getting new status. Now, you could see that there was something else replacing kind of just the tribal kind of differences they had.
Yeah, that's a new identity, right? I think one of the distinctions we made earlier that we discovered are agreements of value and agreements of position. Politically, we're all about our positions, but our identity is much more with our values.
Yeah.
And we also have competing values. So, for example, a former Trump supporter who became a non-Trump supporter that I've come to know very well from that original research that I've kept up with, she came to the conclusion that her love of the law and the office of the presidency was a value, and her love of Trump was a value, and which one was going to be a higher one in a nose-to-nose finish. And I think this gets us to the power of questions generally. Remember I said I was proselytizing about abundance for 25 or 30 years and getting nowhere. And once I began asking the question, is there enough? People began to take responsibility for that answer. One of the things that I discovered when I went to turn is there enough from a casual conversation into something with a website and all of that is it's a hashtag, right? But you cannot put a question mark in a hashtag. You can't put a question mark in a domain name. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of places where question marks in our online discourse are just not part of the discourse. They're special characters.
Yes.
And language matters, right? As you and I would both know very well. And so it's my theory that the reason why people inhabit a different persona online than they do in a coffee shop is because it's unnatural to engage in conversation where I'm just shoving facts at you and you're just shoving facts at me. And that's somehow what the linguistic game that technology evolved is. If you look at Twitter as the global square, is we're just not allowed to have questions, guys. Yeah. And that's really the heart of what this is about. Because if I say to somebody, well, if you have a value of democracy over an individual, which one are you going to choose? Yeah. See, that's not telling people what to choose. It's just reflecting the competing values that they're struggling with and may not even realize they are.
Yeah, I mean, it raises another question for me. We have an idea in the psychoanalytic tradition called containment, and it's about creating a safe enough psychological space where people can actually ask questions, you know, because it gets so polarized on Twitter, it gets so kind of polarized, it becomes just blame games. And that space where you can actually debate, where you can actually look at yourself and see kind of your own drivers, see kind of your own attachments and your own investments in a position safe enough space. So like a lot of the work I do in organizations and in coaching spaces is to really create these spaces where people can actually think together, you know, rather than kind of just react. There's a huge kind of difference there.
Yeah, as I said earlier, we need 1,000 flowers blooming on this, and I can see how professionally conversant you are in the practical application you've made at that, which I say, you know, cheers and bravo. We need many more like you. The only thing that we're really adding to this conversation is just a little bit of a toe in the water for the everyman, engage in this, you know.
Well, it's impressive what you're doing. You said before we went on air something about you're collecting, you're hoping to collect how many signatures?
So we are releasing in 2023, and we're in pre-launch for it now. So people can join the pre-launch if they're moved by this conversation. We believe that agreement is such a high value of humanity, and agreements after war come by treaties. So we're releasing what we believe to be the first treaty in history to be signed by humans, not nations. Mm-hmm. So it's not a petition, it's not a pledge, but it is a commitment, a very simple one paragraph commitment to do my best to make agreement wherever I possibly can with the purpose of my life and whatever else I do. This is not necessarily dependent on anyone else. It's just a treaty with myself, in fact, that I'm making. And we have a strategy in place over the next 5 years to enroll 100 million people in that treaty. And it'll be exactly 100 million, no more, no less. There'll be certificates associated with it. For those in your audience that might be crypto and NFT enthused, there'll be an NFT issued for each of those certificates as well. We expect them to be very valuable keepsakes in 50 years from now. And so people who want to engage in the conversation, we have multiple experiences on istherenough.org. But the most primary one is people who want to join our pre-launch because we want to make a statement to the world that this is the last treaty that we'll ever need to sign. If you sign it with a sufficient number of people, which we think 100 million, which is a little more than 1% of the world, will be enough to create that ripple effect that future societies and leaders of societies will come from a culture where agreement for agreement's sake is actually valued. And we think that agreement is kind of like the everyman's law. And law, if we had no law, we would have no justice. And even laws that are bad and need to be addressed because they are unjust still come from the basis of what replaces war. And it's not just me who says that. Ben Ferenz, the last living Nuremberg prosecutor who put the concept of crimes against humanity into law, says that the way in which war is overcome is by law. We're simply saying that agreement itself is an everyman's law that anybody can make, even a five-year-old. So if people are moved by this conversation, really want to support it, they can certainly follow our social media, which will tell the world that people are following us, of course. But most importantly would be if they can bring themselves to make a commitment to themselves, their history, and their future generations, that they're going to be the one in their generation that replaces war with agreement, not with peace, because peace is a ripple effect of agreement, but with something we can proactively do and which every individual listening to my voice can personally do something about, which is commit themselves to agreement.
Dan, thank you for your passion in speaking with you. I ask my guests at the end of every podcast two questions. What can you say to the audience about what it means to live a good life and create a good society? What does it mean to live a good life and to create a good society? I can see that the good society is kind of what you're doing. Is there enough? Is kind of your work there. What does it mean to live a good life, Dan?
What a great question for your guests. I think that a good life is something which increases choice for yourself and those around you in whatever sequence you'll put those priorities, because life is choice. what we call standard of living is about choice. And I don't know how you do it. And if it was bobbing for apples that would do that, seek that out. Because the world game, making the world work for 100% of humanity, really starts with all of us saying, what is my part that I could do in that? And I think the commonality of all of that is whatever your efforts can do to create more choice around you, more ripples of choice, boy, that's a really good life.
Dan, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very, very much.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Coming up, we have our next advanced coach program. We now have 400 coaches trained internationally. If you're a coach, a leader, or a consultant wishing to develop your coaching skills, come to this advanced program. It's online for 12 weeks, and I'll be leading that program. Our community of practice will be meeting on September the 13th. We have a webinar with the First Nations Worldviews being presented by Michelle McMahon.